We'll hear arguments next in Scott against Illinois. I think you may proceed now, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. On January 31, 1972, in the Circuit Court of Cook County, Illinois, Petitioner Aubrey Scott was convicted of misdemeanor theft, for which he was fined $50. In Illinois, the maximum penalty authorized for this crime is 1 year imprisonment and or a $500 fine. On direct appeal of this conviction, the Illinois Appellate and Supreme Courts held that under Illinois law and the United States Constitution, Scott had no right to counsel or appointed counsel at trial since he was fined and not imprisoned. This court accepted certiorari on two questions, whether the 6th and 14th Amendments guarantee the right to counsel to a defendant charged with an offense punishable in law by imprisonment, regardless of whether the defendant is imprisoned, and second, whether petitioner's trial was so unfair as to deny due process. Now, the trial in this case is not quite what Mr. Justice Rehnquist just alluded to, summary hanging for shoplifting, but it wasn't that far either. With the exception of the right to jury trial, Scott was not advised by the trial court of any of the constitutional safeguards that this court has found fundamental to fairness in a criminal trial.
Your position would apply equally to a $1 fine, would it not?
In this case, it would, yes.
So long as the judge was empowered under the statute to impose a sentence of imprisonment.
Of up to 1 year.
Well, so long as I understand, your position would be the same, and I answer the question of the Chief Justice, if punishment actually imposed were a $1 fine, so long as the statute creating the criminal offense had authorized the trial judge to impose a sentence of confinement, even of 1 day.
Well, we don't necessarily go that far in our brief, and the facts of this case don't require that. Supposedly, the court, if it should deem it appropriate, could make a six-month rule, as it did in the jury trial case.
Well, what if the particular provision, penalty provision, was a fine of not exceeding $100, nothing else, no imprisonment at all? Mm-hmm. Then would your position be the same as you're asserting in your briefs and here today?
Well, our case certainly wouldn't be the same, but our position would be that the crime of misdemeanor theft is sufficiently established at common law and in the minds of the community as a criminal offense that it would invoke the Sixth Amendment safeguards.
Now, the court could make a six-month rule, as you said, but in Argersinger, it didn't.
Yes.
So you're asking us to wholly review Argersinger, everything about it. Is that it?
No. Argersinger, of course, explicitly refused to decide the question in this case.
But it did hold that if it's to be a sentence of confinement, there has to have been counsel at the criminal trial.
Yes.
And you abandon that argument now.
So certainly we abandon, we oppose
totally
that.
You disregard Argersinger in every respect. That's what it comes down to, isn't it?
Well, not the rationale of Argersinger, but we certainly oppose a ruling that you're not entitled to counsel if
penalty is from deciding this case. I'm not sure I agree with you. I mean, presumptively, all state action, including this one, is constitutional unless it's found to violate the federal constitution. And the fact that Argersinger didn't expressly say this state action is all right doesn't mean it's an open question.
Well, except that the opinion expressly stated that, I think it was Mr. Justice Powell in his concurring opinion, raised the question, well, what about cases where the imprisonment is authorized and no jail is imposed? And Mr. Justice Douglas explicitly stated, we're not deciding that. And I think that's in line with the tradition in Powell versus Alabama and Gideon versus Wainwright.
Well, did we need to decide it? Was there any occasion to decide
it? No. My understanding is, frankly, that the petitioners in that case did not ask for such a broad rule. They just said imprisonment only. So it really wasn't put before the court, is my understanding. I'd just like to briefly refer to the facts because I think they do make a telling point as to the importance of right to counsel. Scott, in this case, was not advised of and did not exercise the right to cross-examination, the right to compulsory process of witnesses, the right to make a closing summation, the right to be informed of the elements of the charge against him, and, of course, the right to counsel, either at his own expense or at the state expense if he could not afford counsel. Now, he was allowed to tell his side of the story, but he was not told that he did not have to tell his side of the story. The trial itself was a paradigm of the prejudice that results when a defendant is without counsel in a criminal trial. The clearest example of this prejudice is that a directed verdict motion should have been made and granted after the state had rested because the state had failed to prove a necessary element of its shoplifting prosecution. But Scott, in fact, had not paid for the item he allegedly stole. And Scott, as a layman, had no reason to know that a directed verdict motion could even be made. And I think further prejudice is evident from the fact that after both the state and Scott had rested, the judge admitted that he still had several doubts about the case.
Well, what if the state, instead of having this in the criminal system, had called it a civil fine situation and put a maximum of a $500 civil fine, said we're just going to take shoplifting out of the criminal area. Mm-hmm. And the judge had imposed precisely the same fine at the close of this hearing under a system like that. Would you say he was entitled to counsel?
Well, of course, that would be a closer case, but I still think that the crime of theft is so associated in our history and in the popular mind with the criminal element of a criminal prosecution that I think counsel probably would be required.
So that a suggestion in one of the briefs, I don't remember whether it's yours or not, that the states can deal with this problem by simply taking certain offenses out of the criminal system entirely wouldn't apply in your case.
I don't believe so. I think it would apply, say, jaywalking, that type of thing.
You keep talking about robbery, just shoplifting.
Well, it's defined as theft under Illinois law, theft under $150. It was shoplifting in this case.
Yeah, but you keep saying how horrible a crime it is. I don't think any adjectives are going to help this case.
Except that Illinois classifies it as theft, and they deem it sufficiently serious to authorize a year's imprisonment.
But you indicated your argument would be the same even if it provided for no imprisonment but only a fine.
I think the balancing in that case, it would still be criminal.
To my question, yes or no?
In that case, I think you'd be entitled to the right to counsel. But I respectfully urge that is certainly not our case.
Would you be entitled to the right to counsel on spitting on the sidewalk for ordinance?
Well, if the state authorized years imprisonment, I think that's the prime determinant of what is a criminal offense, and yes.
So it's the, if you had a...
I don't think the right to counsel would probably be appropriate in that case.
And the difference is...
that in that case, it would not have the element of the indicia of what is a criminal offense within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment.
Which
the court has identified seven or eight factors in various cases to define what
you rely on
is criminal. We rely really on all of them because with misdemeanor theft, they all come together to show this is criminal. This has a year's imprisonment. It has the requirement of scienter. It was considered malum in se. It was indictable at common law. This court in Middendorf said it. Larceny, which is basically the same thing, carries the stamp of bad character. It has every criteria.
Is larceny the same as robbery?
As shoplifting? Well, it shows the intent to steal. I think.
Larceny.
I'm sorry, I said larceny. Larceny.
Just so that I have your position in mind, of course, Argenslinger, I never know how to pronounce that case, holds if there's in fact imprisonment, there must be counsel. We don't have that case. You, as I understand, you make alternative arguments. One, that if the statute authorized imprisonment for up to a year or more, then the crime would be sufficiently serious there ought to be counsel.
Or alternatively, I understand you to say that even if the statute does not authorize imprisonment, but the statute has all the other indicia of a common law crime, then it should be right to counsel. But that case isn't before us.
Right. I don't think I have to make that case for this.
It's only the first one we're dealing with today, is when the statute in fact authorizes a year in imprisonment, and it is also a traditional common law crime, is there right to counsel there? That's what we're dealing
That's
with.
That's correct. That's the only issue I see in this
I
case.
See.
Really.
Your theory is such that in conjunction with the question by Mr. Justice Stewart a moment ago, your theory is that this is just kind of an unrolling thing, and it's unrolled from Powell to Gideon to Argersinger. These are just way stations, and presumably this is another way station, and a year from now we'll be asked to expand it further.
Well, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel has been termed an evolving concept.
Do you think that's the way the framers intended?
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say?
What the framers intended? Well,
yes.
There's certain things about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel's application now that clearly had no idea of.
My question is, do you think it's difficult to say what the framers of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel thought about it?
Oh, not in this case. I didn't mean
in this case. I meant generally.
Oh, yes, of course.
You think it is difficult?
Yes.
But isn't it really quite clear that so far as the framers' intent went, it wouldn't have applied at all to a state trial? All it did was guarantee in the Sixth Amendment. If you wanted to bring a lawyer along at his own expense to assist him, that's what it meant. Every historian knows that. Every schoolboy should know that.
Right.
Is that correct?
I believe so. It also meant
a long way from there, haven't we?
Yes, indeed. And I think the framers, it is clear that the framers intended that the right to counsel was essential in all criminal prosecutions at that time.
Well, but the right to counsel is defined by my brother Stewart. If you could afford a lawyer and pay for him and bring him along,
right,
and you were being tried in a federal court, you could do it.
Yes, that's right.
Now, your position, I want to be sure I understand it, is that shoplifting from a store, for all purposes of the stigma and all the consequences, shoplifting from a store is no different from shoplifting from a bank.
In Illinois, if it were charged as theft under $150, it is no different.
That's correct.
His record says theft. So, now, of the five grounds for reversal set forth in petitioner's brief, petitioner relies most strongly, as I indicated, on the Sixth Amendment ground. And there are two alternative rationales for applying the Sixth Amendment right to counsel in this case. The first and simplest is that the right to counsel applies at the terms of the Sixth Amendment specified in all criminal prosecutions. And the court has never limited the application of any Sixth Amendment right that has been applied to the states through the 14th Amendment on the basis of the gravity of the crime, except, of course, for the right to jury trial. But in Argersinger, the court pointed out that the historical reasons for limiting the right to jury to serious offenses do not exist with respect to the right to counsel. And the court specifically rejected the premise that crimes punishable by less than 6 months imprisonment may be tried without a lawyer simply because they may be tried without a jury. Now, the right to counsel also requires wider application than the right to jury because of the nature of the criminal trial process. And the court has repeatedly pointed out that the right to counsel and not the right to jury is essential to a fair trial, to the integrity of the fact-finding process. And as the court pointed out in Fuller versus Oregon, the right to counsel is necessary so that defendants may recognize and take advantage of the Sixth Amendment's other fair trial safeguards. Since the right to counsel is therefore the Sixth Amendment right that is most important to the actual achievement of a fair trial, it would contradict the Sixth Amendment's essential purpose of assuring fair trials to apply the right to counsel more narrowly than the other Sixth Amendment rights. Moreover, respondents' argument that the right to counsel does not apply to petitioner's prosecution renders petitioner's right to a jury trial meaningless. For notwithstanding respondents' assertions to the contrary, a layman simply cannot adequately present a case to a jury in any circumstances. The right to counsel has been nested immediately in a time of punishable in law by over 6 months imprisonment. Otherwise, the right to jury would simply be a nullity.
I don't happen to agree with your assertion that a layman can't possibly present a defense to a jury if he wants to. If it's a justice of the peace, misdemeanor type of jury. In my own practice, I have seen that done.
I've never seen it done. It's hard for me, as a trial lawyer, to envision it. I am.
Have you never seen juries acquit defendants who have not chosen to retain counsel on relatively low-grade misdemeanors?
I have never seen it. There aren't that many misdemeanor jury trials in the area where I practice. But it happens. Now, if the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is to be applied according to its terms in all criminal prosecutions, then there is only one issue in this case, and that is whether a prosecution for misdemeanor theft not resulting in imprisonment is a criminal prosecution within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment. And as I previously stated, in this case, it has all the indicia of what is a criminal prosecution, and I don't think respondents really contest that this is not, in fact, a criminal prosecution. But regardless of whether the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is to be applied according to its terms, the right applies in this case under the test used for applying any Sixth Amendment right to the states, and that is whether or not it is necessary for fundamental fairness. Now, counsel is as fundamental to fairness in the trial of a misdemeanor that does not result in imprisonment as it was in Gideon in the trial of a felony, and as it was in Argersinger in the trial of a misdemeanor resulting in imprisonment. There is no functional difference between the trial of a felony and a misdemeanor that would make a layman a more competent advocate in one than in the other. Moreover, I think respondents' distinctions between misdemeanors that do and do not result in imprisonment for the right to counsel purpose is in total contradiction of the rationale of Argersinger. If an unconstitutional misdemeanor crime and conviction that results in imprisonment does not comport with fundamental fairness, as Argersinger held, then fundamental fairness also must be denied by an unconstitutional misdemeanor trial and conviction that does not result in imprisonment, because a trial cannot simply be suddenly transformed into a fair fact-finding process because after the trial, the judge decides not to sentence the defendant to jail.
Yet that was the hypothesis of Argersinger, wasn't it?
I contend that it wasn't, that Argersinger stated that a misdemeanor trial cannot be a fair fact-finding process without counsel. It's as essential as it was in Gideon.
But it went on to say that we don't have, as you say, putting it most, I think most favorably to your case, we don't have to decide whether this opinion or reasoning applies where there's no threat of imprisonment.
Right.
And you say it's just inconceivable that that sort of a rationale makes any sense, that you could draw the line between threat of imprisonment and no threat of imprisonment.
Yes, I find it logically that it is very difficult to follow. If Argersinger was premised on the needs for counsel for a fair trial, as the opinion indicates,
do you think it was irrational when courts made the distinction between felonies and other types of crimes?
Well, I think that's a legislative task, and
no,
I think in Babylon...
When courts did it.
I'm sorry?
When courts distinguished the rights of counsel, Sixth Amendment mm-hmm. rights, between felonies and other types of cases.
Well, I think the court has, since then,
got rid of that distinction in many cases. I think between the
Well, Argersinger was the first case that could be interpreted as that, besides the contempt.
If you think that the rationale was not, as Mr. Justice Rehnquist just stated, of Argersinger.
Do I think that it...
You think that was not the basis of decision in that case?
No, the rationale from the opinion is clear that counsel is necessary for a fair trial.
If the man may go to jail. And is it not clear that if the judge trying such a case must decide in advance... If I find this man guilty, am I likely to send him to prison, to jail? And then if he decides that, he'd better furnish mm-hmm. him counsel. But if he decides that probably he isn't going to send him to prison, but only fine him,
right.
then he goes ahead without counsel.
Certainly. Well, that's how the holding of Argersinger has been interpreted, and that's the narrowest possible reading. But, as I say, if Argersinger held, as it did, that there's no difference in the, for fairness purposes, in the trial of a felony and a misdemeanor,
then it just has to follow that there is no difference for fairness purposes between the trial of a misdemeanor that results in imprisonment and one that doesn't.
The trial of one that has only a fine in it.
Yes, certainly.
I mean, your argument certainly would invalidate any trial where the only punishment authorized is a fine, unless he has counsel.
if it were a criminal prosecution within the meaning of the Sixth Amendment.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and that's the issue in this case. Is misdemeanor theft a criminal prosecution?
The old proceeding is what's in here.
Yes, it's very short. Yes.
And you need a lawyer. This is probably a plea of guilt.
Well, I think he maintained his innocence. He didn't think he was pleading guilty.
Well, he said that he went in and picked up and had him unlock a case and take out a briefcase. And he walked around with the briefcase and then started out the door with it.
No, he maintained he was still looking for the sales girl. And that he was stopped inside.
At the door going out into State Street.
Well, he doesn't say whether he was at the
door,
I believe. Well, near the door. But he's maintained that he wasn't going out. He was still looking.
What was he going to State Street for? She was in the store.
Well, he was still in the store. Yes. But he was looking for the sales girl.
Mr. Elton?
Yes.
You
say in one of your questions presented the person that the Sixth and Fourteenth Amendments of the United States Constitution guarantees the right to counsel and defend his charges with an offense punishable under state law by imprisonment. Now, I would gather from your answer to Mr. Justice White's question that although that may be theoretically presented by the facts of this case, you regard as it as being utterly immaterial whether or not the statute authorizes imprisonment or not, so long as it's a criminal prosecution.
No, certainly not utterly material. I think imprisonment is one of the authorized imprisonment is one of the essential, the most important indicia.
No, you asked me
just You were arguing that Argusinger said that without counsel you can't have a fair trial.
That's right.
And I said that therefore if the statute only authorizes a fine, and it's a criminal prosecution,
yes,
would your theory apply? And you said yes.
Oh, yes, but my answer to Mr. Justice Rehnquist was that imprisonment is not irrelevant, immaterial, because that is.
But your theory wouldn't. But your submission is that it would be just as unfair a trial if only a fine.
That's
was,
right.
Yes.
But I'm not saying that unfairness itself invokes the Sixth Amendment. I'm saying it has to be criminal, and authorized imprisonment is the essential indicium of criminality. Of the criminal.
Answer is these three of us in exactly the contrary in the earlier argument.
Aware of that.
Well, you're saying that unless imprisonment is authorized, you would not think the case could be deemed a criminal case.
No, the point is that in a variety of cases, the court has pointed to six or seven different factors
to determine whether an offense
is criminal or civil. And I don't think there's a general rule that will take care of all cases. I think the court has to look at.
So you can imagine a lot of cases where the only punishment authorized is a fine that you would agree are criminal cases.
I would think so. I think if the
well,
state
in those cases, at least, you would say that whether or not imprisonment is authorized.
I would say kidnapping, murder, certainly.
That he must, that they must have counsel.
Yes.
Even though, let's assume that there are some cases where only a fine is authorized. And you can imagine some that you would agree are criminal cases.
I can imagine. I can't imagine the state necessarily removing imprisonment, say, for something like murder.
But
that happened, I would say that is sufficiently identified as a criminal.
There must be counsel because it is in the criminal thing.
I would think so, because I think the Sixth Amendment by itself demands that.
Now, respondent's argument rests primarily on the proposition that it is too expensive for the state to provide the right to counsel to indigent misdemeanants who are not imprisoned. But there is no legal authority for the proposition that under either the Sixth Amendment or due process, the state can convict a defendant through fundamentally unfair fact-finding procedures because of the cost of providing fair procedures. In Gideon, in Argusinger, and in In re Gall,
the cost of extending the right to counsel was substantial. But in not one of those cases did the court weigh the cost of counsel against the need for counsel for fairness.
Well, how do you say the cost in Argusinger was expensive when the holding of Argusinger did not bring about any expense where no confinement was involved?
Well, although there are not accurate, reliable statistics on this point, I think the greatest expense in terms of providing right to counsel in misdemeanor cases happened already as a result of Artisan, where the states had developed for the first time systems for supplying counsel to misdemeanors. And those systems in practically all the states are now in place.
You mean the court couldn't take judicial notice of the reality that in the overwhelming majority of these minor misdemeanor cases, there is no confinement? You say there are no statistics.
Right, but I don't think the court can take judicial notice that the right to counsel is not available in those cases and is not made available in those cases. I would think the assumption in the absence of such statistics has to be that most judges are supplying or affording the right to counsel in order to comply with rational principles of sentencing and with legislative intent in authorizing something as a possible sentence. I think that was Mr. Justice Powell's statement, what would happen in his concurring opinion in Artisan, and I think that's what's in fact happened in that case. Moreover, respondents' cost argument is based on the false assumption that the state's only duty is to finance the prosecution, but the state also has a duty to assure that the criminal trial process is a fair one. The adversary process is really no more than an empty phrase if the state can fund the full apparatus of effective prosecution, including judges, court reporters, state attorneys, bailiffs, et cetera, and then just refuse to pay the fraction of that cost that would go for defense counsel.
What if a state were to set up a system whereby the state was not represented by an attorney at these mm-hmm. trials, just a typical British police officer mm-hmm. comes into the mm-hmm. British magistrate's court?
Well, of course, again, there was a prosecutor here, but I think the fairness argument might be a little different, but that doesn't affect our Sixth Amendment argument, and the fact is that a layman has so much at stake here that I would think that counsel
would be required. So your funding argument is really a make-weight, because even if the state were to fund neither side, you would say you'd still ought to have counsel.
Well, no. Yes, you still should have counsel, but I don't see that it's a make-weight.
Well, you were saying that a state has a duty to equalize and
make an advocate in reality. One way to do it is by
both sides have counsel. Another way is to downgrade it so neither side has counsel.
Right. That would reduce the unfairness in the adversary process of not having one side represented by counsel. I don't think that would affect the Sixth Amendment. And certainly in all the courts that I'm familiar with, in my jurisdiction, prosecutors are always there. I would point out that one statistic that is very reliable is that at least 16 states, including both urban and rural states, do provide the right to counsel for cases that have authorized imprisonment. And there have been no showing that those states have suffered by that. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Oh, very well. Ms. Pampas-Garbage.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the question before this Court is whether or not the right to counsel, which was articulated in Gideon versus Wainwright and extended in Artisinger versus Hamlin, should be extended. Now, the actual question before this Court is where to draw the line. Counsel argues that imprisonment should be, or counsel argued in its brief, that imprisonment should be the focus, imprisonment and non-imprisonment, as an authorized penalty should be the focus of any actual right to counsel. However, before this Court, he now states that the criminal, that it doesn't matter whether or not there is authorized imprisonment or not. He states that regardless of what the actual penalty is, if there are other indicia of criminality, right to counsel would be extended. And I would imagine that in a future case, he would come before this Court and say, as long as there are other indicia of criminality, don't consider what those consequences actually entail to the defendant. Don't consider what the actual cost are to the state. Don't consider whether or not the defendant is capable of defending himself against those charges. His position is that once you decide that something is a criminal prosecution because some of the indicia of criminality exist, after that you can't ask any further questions. It's our position that this court must ask some further questions, and we submit that the right to counsel in this case should be based after looking at, should be decided after looking and balancing two factors. First of all, considering the results to the defendant based on the consequences which a defendant may face and also his ability to defend himself in a court, and secondly, considering the burden on the state courts and the state criminal justice system. I would first like to focus my argument, and although I will not cite statistics, I would first like to focus my argument on a concern which this court has indicated grave concern about. It's the efficacy of the criminal justice system. Now, counsel in his brief argues that there are no reliable statistics for indigency, and we really can't gauge what kind of effect an extension of the type that he talks about will cost to the states. He says, after all, that some predictions have percentages of as low as 10% in indigency rates. And I would submit to the court that that's not the kind of figures that we are looking at. The burden that will be imposed on the states is tremendous. Reliable figures show there is between a 40 and a 47% indigency rate in misdemeanor cases. Those kind of figures, when applied to the approximately 5.5 million misdemeanors that are non-traffic offenses, which are prosecuted a year, indicates that the burden on the court system will be tremendous. And that's not
Ms.
just...
Kushkowicz, yes, can sir. We assume that in this case the petitioner was an indigent at the time of the trial?
Your Honor, although that was not established before the actual trial, subsequently to that and before the appellate court argument and the Illinois Supreme Court argument, there were a petitioner filed an affidavit of indigency showing his assets and liabilities. And for purposes of the Illinois hearings, there was an assumption made. Yes.
That he was an indigent.
That he was an indigent.
Part of his defense was that he had $300 or $400 in his pocket at the time of the shoplifting.
Yes, Your Honor. That was part of the defense. We have not sought, because we had conceded that issue both in the appellate court.
We proceed on the premise that he was an indigent.
That's right. We have to proceed on that premise because we proceeded on that premise in the lower courts. The burden which the states will face it can be viewed in two different situations. First of all, if we look on the burdens at places like in large counties, the effect of this rule will be to increase the backlog, increase the workload, and most importantly, I think, in terms of the criminal justice system, it'll decrease the representation which we provide for defendants. Defendants who are actually entitled presently under the Gideon and Argersinger to receive representation will be represented by the same people who now represent who will be then representing persons who have very little need for counsel. Now, it is our position in this court that because of the character and the nature of the misdemeanor courts and the charges involved, there is no right to counsel, that a defendant can, in fact, defend himself adequately and receive a fair trial in a misdemeanor court without having the assistance of counsel. Now,
does that include if he's given a year?
No, Your Honor. Under Argersinger, he can't be given any imprisonment.
The land is so broad there.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, we would agree that under the standard of Argersinger versus Hamlin, he cannot be given 1 year imprisonment. If the authority is in the statute for 1 year imprisonment and counsel is not appointed, it's very clear what the rule is. That imprisonment may not be imposed, although the alternative sentences may be. But counsel's argument is based on an argument that there is no way that a misdemeanor defendant can adequately defend himself. And yet, the ability to defend himself is is adequately demonstrated by this particular record.
I'll interrupt there.
Yes.
There is really kind of a logical dilemma here. If he were to be sentenced for a year, he could still defend himself adequately if it's the same charge and all the rest, couldn't he? Why does the sentence have anything to do with whether he needs a lawyer or not in order adequately to defend himself?
Because, Your Honor, I believe that we've got to look at this case in terms of
Well, that's a tenable argument, but I understand it, and maybe if for all these practical reasons we should leave the line right where it draws it there. But in terms of fairness, I mean, the need for a lawyer to be sure the issues are fairly presented in the adversary way in trial. I don't understand why it makes any difference whether he's going to be given the year sentence or the judge says in advance, I won't give you the year sentence. Isn't it precisely the same trial problem of getting the evidence out in a fair way?
I think the problem becomes... The actual problem is the same. What you have to do is defend yourself in a fair trial. What we have decided, and my argument is this, is that we have to draw the line at some point. And this is a reasonable line to draw because we've removed the worst possible criminal sanction. We can no longer imprison him.
But that's unrelated to the question whether he'll be able to get the facts out in a fair way. I mean, it's just that as a practical matter, we've got to draw the line. We've got to draw the line somewhere.
Well, I think that he would be able to get the facts out in a fair way. I think the question is more precisely answered if you consider what we want to consider as fair, where we impose imprisonment and where we don't. And I think that what we've provided by providing counsel goes beyond fairness. I think what we've provided in our assistance to counsel cases is very extreme, detailed, I don't mean extreme, I mean detailed probing into any possibilities that may exist for a reasonable doubt. And that's the standard that we wish to use where imprisonment is possible. But that doesn't mean that anything less is not a fair trial and that you cannot actually bring out the facts fairly without counsel there to bring them out.
May I ask two brief related questions? Under your view, could the trial judge impose probation?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court could impose probation under our view.
Lawyer.
Without a lawyer.
What if the man violates the terms of probation? Could he be put in prison?
Under our position, Your Honor, we would argue, yes, he could be put in prison, that the relationship is too indirect, and it requires additional acts before he's put in prison.
And supposing he doesn't pay the fine. So he's fined. He says, well, I've decided not to pay it. Could he be put in prison then?
If the frame of your question is that if he decides to pay not to pay the fine and it's deliberate action,
he's
I would
no
say
lawyer see it as trial.
Yes, I would say he could be in prison. However, I would point out that
so that every case really carries a potential of imprisonment, doesn't it?
Many cases, I would argue, would carry a potential of imprisonment. I would point out, as far as your fine question is concerned, that if the reason he doesn't pay the fine is because he's indigent, we are of course prohibited from going. From imprisonment.
Well, of course, by hypothesis, we're only dealing with cases of people who are indigent. Mm-hmm. That we're not talking about those who can hire their own lawyers.
That's true.
And so they're, by hypothesis, a category, they're going to have some difficulty paying their fine.
And I think the court has before it presently in Hunter versus Dean,
right,
the varieties of ways in which states can permit or are required to permit indigents to pay fines.
Right. But your interpretation of I just want to be sure, uh-huh, your interpretation is that either probation is possible, which could be revoked, or alternatively, an indigent can be assessed a fine of up to, $500 here, which he might be unable to pay, and then he could go to jail.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be right to my position. But additionally, I would point out that should further decisions, and this question has been under review in many of the state courts that have been faced with the Argus in your decision, should the consensus of opinion or eventually a decision of this court decide that it's too direct a relationship, the state is prepared to live with those kinds of consequences because I think that comes within the bounds of prosecutorial discretion. What would then happen would be you would have penalties that are somewhat less, don't carry all of the stigmas that you would get if you actually had counsel.
Was this man entitled to a transcript of his trial?
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
And he had a right to appeal?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
But he didn't have a right to a lawyer?
But he did not have a right to a lawyer at the trial level.
How does he know he has a right to a transcript in Illinois? Does the judge tell him?
Yes, Your Honor. He is notified of his right to a transcript and of his right to appeal.
Before the trial starts?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I believe that's done after trial, but I'm not exactly sure.
Is it standard practice to have a court reporter in the courtroom in all misdemeanor proceedings?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
How many states have complied with Augustine by saying we'll give it in all misdemeanor cases?
It's approximately 16, Your Honor. That's in all misdemeanors regardless, or at least all misdemeanors that are punishable by imprisonment where it's an authorized penalty. There's some dispute between petitioner and myself as to the exact number, but it's approximately 16 to 20.
Wouldn't it be possible to meet your cost argument by, instead of giving counsel to the defendant, having no prosecuting attorney and simply having a policeman and the defendant come in? If that were the way this court were to go, your opponent says that would not be sufficient.
If there is a cost argument, I don't know.
I thought you were arguing that if we followed petitioner's adopted petitioner's reasoning, state would be less able to provide counsel for those who needed it.
Yes, Your Honor, I was arguing that, and it would seem to me that if you had, to the extent that the court is worried about the unequal ability of the parties to present their respective sides, I believe that you could diminish that particular worry in addition to diminishing the worry of the cost by providing a policeman versus a defendant.
You might have to pay your magistrates more because they would be presumably the only ones that knew anything about the law.
That's true. And additionally, I think that one problem with that I would point out at this point would be that the burden in these cases is beyond a reasonable doubt on the state. And you would have to, by putting police officers in, I think you would make it much more difficult for the state to meet the burden and cause various problems for the state in meeting that burden when you have an untrained person with that kind of a burden instead of a burden of presenting your case and presenting the facts and the evidence. Now, in addition to the costs argument and legal in large communities, I would also point out to this court that the effect on rural communities has been shown since the decision in Argersinger to be exactly what Mr. Justice Powell had predicted that it could be. In a study, The Other Face of Justice, which was conducted in approximately 1974, the study found that 71% or 61% of the judges interviewed in rural counties, this is where in approximately over 2,000 counties in the United States have assigned public defender systems. And in interviewing these particular judges, 61% of those judges indicated that they had tremendous difficulties meeting the Argersinger standard. Now, if they had tremendous difficulties in those communities meeting the Argersinger standard, then they would have even more difficulty meeting a broader standard. Now, there was further indication in that study that the response of many judges in these communities, and they indicated that there was a twofold problem. The twofold problem consisted of the cost and, in addition, a scarcity of lawyers in these areas. And they indicated their response to the Argersinger decision was simply not to incarcerate defendants. Because they could not incarcerate them if they found them guilty, they simply did not appoint counsel, unless they appointed counsel, they simply did not appoint counsel and did not incarcerate. Now, if you extend that to the position that petitioner takes in this case, the conclusion is inescapable that what will happen is that municipalities and other counties and localities will not be able to enforce their own laws. They will not be able to prosecute at all because of their inability to...
do they have enough money to hire a prosecutor in those small communities?
What they do in...
Do they have enough money to pay for transcripts, to authorize appeals and all that?
Well,
if they don't, what do they have to do? They have to appropriate more money, don't they?
Yes, they do.
If that's the only way to guarantee a defendant a constitutional right to a fair trial, isn't the burden on the legislature to put up the money that's necessary to accomplish it.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. If the
so how does this argument go to the question of whether it's fair or unfair at all? It's just a question of whether some states have not found it appropriate to spend the money that's required in certain parts of the criminal process.
Or simply don't have the money.
And is this how we test the fairness of the Constitution, by what a state legislature is willing to appropriate?
No, Your Honor. What my argument is that in misdemeanor cases...
It's not worth the money.
No. In misdemeanor cases, fairness can be ensured by less than what is being asked here. And what is being
asked... Well, then
we
don't even have to look at these 16 states. That's true in Chicago and New York as well. I suggest to you that the question whether these 16 rural areas or whatever they are, whether they can afford it or not, really is not relevant to the question whether it's required by fundamental fairness or not. Maybe you're right there. Maybe it's not required. But then it's not required in Chicago or New York either, is it?
The right to counsel for
yes.
In terms of funding? No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that the right to counsel is not required in any jurisdiction.
I understand that. I just don't understand how this question about whether some small communities have enough money to pay the public defender goes to the question, the constitutional question at all. Is that a valid argument?
I would say that it's a valid argument to be considered in defining the scope of the right to counsel. At some time, this Court is going to have to, when presented with further arguments, if not in this case, but in further cases, you're going to have to draw a line. And the question is, what considerations will you put in? What will you consider? What factors? And I suggest the costs and the ability of communities to enforce the kind of rules that you're drawing should be taken in as a practical consideration. Although petitioner does not urge the point here before the Court today, I would... Additionally, before I go on to my next point, I would point out to the Court that under petitioner's hypothesis, the right to counsel should extend not only to misdemeanor cases, but to the vast majority of traffic cases. And the statistics are self-explanatory within the brief. This would impose even a much heavier burden than the right to counsel in misdemeanor cases. Such a heavy burden, in fact, that I would submit that this Court cannot adopt an imprisonment in law, an authorized imprisonment standard as being urged by petitioner. Now, in his brief, petitioner argues that the predictive evaluation, which is a part of the Argersinger standard, is unconstitutional and violates due process. Now, it's inconceivable to me, and I'm sure it would be inconceivable to many of the courts within the system in the United States. This court in 1972 would have told the entire nation, all the judges in the country, would have fixed a procedure whereby they could determine whether or not to appoint counsel and ask and propose an unconstitutional method. Now, we would submit that the decision as to whether or not to get counsel is exactly what this Court said that it, the kind of procedure that this Court said it would be, definitely within the capabilities of an experienced judge aided by a prosecutor. Now, I think this situation clearly indicates that the predictive evaluation technique is a valid one for the Court to proceed with and is not in any manner unconstitutional. There would seem to be no difficulty, and in this situation, had Argersinger been in effect when this case was tried and decided, for the Court to take a look at the particular offense before it and see that it was a misdemeanor theft, that the value of the property was very low, that it was not charged under an enhancement theory. The only other conceivable question that it could have asked would have been to the prosecutor, do you intend to ask for jail time? Given that kind of situation, we would submit that the Court could make a very reasoned decision that in this case, it would be so highly unlikely that I would impose jail time that there's no need for me to appoint counsel. We would submit that that is an entirely logical and constitutional kind of a procedure. Secondly,
I ask one other question about this particular case. Is there in Illinois a lesser included offense that could have applied to the facts here that would have not carried a jail sentence? Something like shoplifting or some other petty theft type crime?
Your Honor, just... No, I don't believe that there would be.
So that under Illinois law, if he was to be prosecuted, it had to be with a crime that provided for jail time?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's true. Secondly, I would point out regarding the predictive evaluation standard that they do not abrogate in any fashion the intent of state legislatures that there be a broad scope of sentencing alternatives. The broad scope of sentencing alternatives exists at any rate, and all the judge does by discarding one is to preserve the options which are contained in the statute and all of the other sentencing alternatives. Now, unless the court has any further questions, the respondent would respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the Illinois courts below. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Ellison?
Yes.
You have 2 minutes left.
I would just like to address the equal protection argument, which I believe is compelling in this case and made more compelling in light of Mayer v. City of Chicago and Ross v. Moffitt. Mayer makes clear that the lack of imprisonment as a penalty cannot justify withholding any criminal procedural safeguards on the basis of defendant's ability to pay. And then Ross makes clear that the equal protection rationale of Douglas versus California, which required appointment of a counsel on initial appeal, applies with far more force to the appointment of counsel at trial, where the defendant is fighting to maintain his presumption of innocence and where tactically and strategically counsel can do the most good. It's really too late usually to appoint a counsel on appeal when the pro se defendant has not put in the record the fact that he needs for his case. I would just like to point out that in our brief as now, we do not maintain that the authorized imprisonment is in itself necessarily the only criteria of criminality in this case, that there are other criteria as well that add up to this being a criminal prosecution. Was there any further questions? Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments in the next case beginning at 1 o'clock.